Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Sunday, December 1st, 2013, episode 47, Bee Bombs. Welcome everyone to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England, and I'll be your master of ceremonies for the next hour or so. So much to talk about, so little time. In this episode, I'm going to get to one of the topics that has been on the hit list for a long time now, the use of nucleus hives in the sustainable apiary. Also on the agenda, I'm going to talk about state beekeeping programs. Not association programs, but literal states of the United States. We'll talk about a product by Bayer in research for controlling varroa mite, and then we'll bounce into roundtable topics. A long-lost episode resurfaces, honey caramel sauce, DIY bee trap, and thoughts about a hive stand upgrade. And last but not least, a quick note on the potential for intelligent hive sensors. A little bit under the weather today, got a head cold, chest cold, coughing, scratchy throat, but we're going to muster our way through it. So sit back, buckle up, and pour the hot toddies. It's time for the Beekeeper's Corner. Okay, local hive report in 3, 2, 1. Oops, nothing to see here. Nothing's changed since last episode. All 4 hives are nestled in for the winter and all are still alive. That's the same report we hope to give week after week. Local hive report, done. My mother used to say, how do you like them apples? Don't worry about the brevity of the local hive report. We've got plenty for you. Segment number 1 in 3, 2, 1. Segment number 1 has the title, State of Affairs. To open the show, I'm going to talk about something a bit different. It's an observational piece on the way the U.S. state agricultural departments interface with beekeepers. For us in New Jersey, November is the time to renew your apiary registrations. And while filling out the form for my yard, I thought about a number of commentaries about this process. The focus of the segment will be about the website presentations and rules in states, but before I get to the meat of it, I want to have a conversation with you, the listener. In my travels, I hear a number of opinions about interfacing with bee inspectors. I'm always amused, especially in online forums, on the take that beekeepers have with bee inspectors. I guess we're spoiled in New Jersey because I don't think I know a single person who doesn't like and respect our bee inspector, Tim Schuler, and the people that work with him. I guess if you have 50 choices, 50 personalities, that someone is not entirely good to work with in that pool. But on the whole, any bee inspectors that I've met have been unique, helpful, and knowledgeable individuals. Most times, complaints about inspectors are really toward the program that they have to work with and the policies of the state itself and not the team or individuals. In my mind, I encourage all of you to get to know your inspector or inspector teams. I believe it is better to have them standing in your corner, and if there is a pang of angst in that suggestion, the first question is, do you have to look within? That's a great trait to have, to start with oneself and how you run your operations. I don't wish to insinuate that you're doing something wrong. In fact, I'll go down another route. In our great state of New Jersey, there's a guide to keeping bees in populated areas. I've mentioned it here in the past, and hopefully your state has something too. Having insights into the rules of engagement is to your benefit, and if something should ever come to pass where you have a conflict with your neighbors, being aligned with the guidelines is to your advantage. I don't know how anyone who has a run-in thinks that officials would be able to back them up if fundamental things that the state has in place are not met. My guidance to you is get to know your inspector. This is about a duh thing, duh, that I'm about to say. They are your ally, and they are a more prudent resource to seek counsel with than perhaps your local elected officials, who are not always aligned with crazy people who want to keep stinging insects. Okay, now let's get to the observations about how the states interface with beekeepers. I'm going to talk about a handful of points. how to access the information you need from representatives, the general things that they tell you, the general things that they are looking for, and a footnote on the stylings of the state approach to communicate to you. First up, let's talk about the facets that almost every state hits the same note on. Registration. Just about every state informs you on the outset that you need to register your bees. At the surface, they want two things here. If there is something going on in your neighborhood, they need your information to notify you, and they want to know where your yard is so they can do whatever is possible to contain any potential outbreaks and minimize the impacts for all concerned. Some states go as far as requiring you to physically label your hives and even post notices at places you keep bees. Next is importation. A good inspector team can keep things safe at home, but they'd be foolish if they didn't mind what is being brought in or control what is going out. Here they depend upon each other to project and protect states from interstate commerce. If you're buying bees, they should come with a certificate for importation from the state they originate from. Inspectors issue bee supply companies with certificates which come with a reasonable expectation that they've been inspected for disease, that qualified queen operations are in place, and that you won't run into problems when ordering bees that have been backed up with a certificate. Next up is managing spread of disease. Inspectors have rules and guidelines for managing the spread of disease. Some even spell out the duty of the beekeeper to report disease and or pest problems. They have the right to quarantine and destroy equipment if need be in the course of their duty, and yes, that means they could come on your property. And finally, almost all of them have a clause that they can take action on abandoned apiaries, and if need be, they can issue penalties for violators. Movable comb and more. The last part is related to the spread of disease, and it requires you to use movable comb hives. In order to facilitate the inspections, bee inspectors need the ability to get to the internals of the hive and inspect comb. Some go as far as calling out rearing, apiaries, package inspections, queen inspections, and such. Oklahoma comes to mind as one of the more detailed states out in the U.S. Some, on the other hand, have none of this called out, and as you can guess, your mileage may vary from state to state. Okay, I've run through the facets of bee laws that you'll commonly see. Now I want to share some observations about how the information is presented to you, the beekeeper. It strikes me how they are presented and written. So here are a sample of states and how they provide the data from what I can find. Alaska and Florida are written in short clause-like statements. Nebraska, Maryland, Illinois, Iowa, Wyoming, and many others, their statutes are written like bylaws, document with title, clauses, and sections. Arkansas, on the other hand, is a readable paragraph form presentation to you, the beekeeper. Connecticut, legalese, and huge run-on paragraphs. I don't know how anybody could understand anything there. Georgia, Kentucky, buried in the full legislative items on the LexisNexis website. Now, Louisiana has a brochure-style presentation. Some are well-written and well-presented format with a readable font, and some of them could be the equivalent of trying to read the phone book for a meeting, if you know what I mean. State apiarists probably don't have much say on how the information is presented, but I'm sure that they can consider an approachable format such as the one Louisiana provided. So beyond presentation, there were a few things that stood out as unusual. In Tennessee, there is a clause about the management of used bee equipment. It says no person shall sell or give any other person used equipment until it is sanitized by a method approved by the state apiarist. It goes as far as saying it doesn't apply to equipment occupied by bees, but that's an interesting clause to have to enforce. I'm guessing that the apiarist and the staff, if they have one, is a busy team. The Utah regulations spell out that salvage operations of diseased colonies must be performed in a tightly screened enclosure to prevent exposure of equipment to non-affected bees. If I'm not mistaken, it actually shows a picture of this, and everything is screened, and their number one objective is to make sure that healthy bees do not enter into the affected area. In Wyoming, they have a classification of registration for the hobbyist. It goes on to say that if the department determines that too many of them, meaning hives, are close together, they can refuse to grant additional registrations in that locale. A hobbyist apiary is one with fewer than five hives. This is all interesting stuff. There's a webpage on Wikipedia that someone put together with the links to the state laws. Many states are missing, including New Jersey, I might add. I think it's a great resource to beekeepers to have this information available, as many beekeepers are blissfully unaware of the laws that govern them, and that is a shame. My suggestion to you is learn your laws and abide by them, encourage others to, and be a responsible beekeeper for all our sakes. I'll have a link in our show notes to the New Jersey registration form, the Wikipedia page I mentioned, and links for beekeeping in New Jersey if you want to take a look at it. For segment number two, we'll get to the main feature, which is on nucleus hives. We hosted a session on nucleus hives for our association at a recent meeting, and I've been meaning to get to this important topic in detail in one of these episodes. When I first started keeping bees, nukes were for new hive starts exclusively. In New Jersey, it seems that the use of nucleus hives in the apiary was just not in play, because you wouldn't think that you can get one to survive the winter. Nukes through the winter? That was crazy talk. Then word came of this guy in Vermont who was doing talks on nucleus hives and promoting that you could overwinter them to get a great start on the spring. Amongst our friends, we talk about it like the double dog dare for sticking your tongue to the flagpole. Who was going to try it? I have to credit Bob Kloss with being the bravest amongst us to overwinter some nukes. He pulled four of them together, bound them up side by side, and got them through the winter like the stud that he is. Coming out the other side, it was like, it's nothing but a thing, but trust me when I say, you question your sanity when you consider trying to figure it out for the first time. For what it's worth, I still haven't had the opportunity because I didn't have the equipment or the bees to pull it off. I so look forward to getting to be a part of the club of New Jersey overwinterers. So Bob is my hero, and he's the one that actually introduced me to the ways of Michael Palmer. There's an incomparable video posted on Vimeo of Mike that became a moment for me personally on this topic. There was beekeeping before that moment, and there was beekeeping enlightenment after that moment. So what's the big deal with this nucleus stuff anyway? Want more bees? Nucleus hives make bees. Want more honey? Take those bees and complement your workforce. Or use the nucleus to build more honey. Need more comb? Nucleus hives are comb-making factories. Want to buy some more equipment but don't have the money? How about selling some nucleus hives to sustain your beekeeping budget? Need backup bees? Yep, nucleus hives. They have bees and queens. Speaking of queens, want to raise some queens? Sure, nucleus hives. Truth be told, they are the Ginsu knife of the apiary. So breaking this down, let's talk about the highlights here and provide insight on a game plan for getting started in the world of nucleus hives. The best description I've ever heard of a nucleus is that it's a regular hive in miniature. There might be some who are new to the topic and haven't heard of such a thing. So for those of you who fall into that camp, this is for you. A nucleus, or a nuke, as I'll refer to it from now on, is a half a hive body. It typically is a full deep in height and holds 5 frames instead of 10. Not to confuse matters, but nukes can be 4 frames, 3 frames, or even 2 if that's your thing. But for purposes of this discussion, we'll stick to the conventional 5-frame box. Nukes come in many forms. You can get cardboard ones, plastic ones, styrofoam ones, double ones. You can even make a standard deep into a nuke box by wedging a divider in the middle. For the purpose of most of this discussion, we'll stick with a purpose-built 5-frame Langstroth-type box sitting on a dedicated nuke bottom board and adorned with a nuke with inner cover and telescoping or outer cover. This equipment is easily available at your favorite equipment supplier, or you could do what I've done with some of mine and repurpose old worn-out deeps. You take the boxes with worn-out corners and cut them to shape and nail them together. They may not have rabbit corners like conventional box, but nukes don't have to be structurally stable as a deep, and butt joining the boards is perfectly fine for their use. Using old boxes, giving them new life, and it saves you from having to do the thing that most home beekeepers can't do, which is cut the handholds. Kevin moment. Did you know that rabbit, as in rabbit joint, is spelled by R-A-B-B-E-T? Isn't that interesting? Don't have any old boxes with handheld cutouts around? Just cut 3/4-inch boards and fasten some handhelds on them. It's an acceptable way to do it, but it does become a deterrent for overwintering as the boxes can't sit flush with each other when placed side by side. More on that a little bit later. So now that you have a lead on equipment, let's get to populating the boxes and their use. The best time to get a head start on this is going into spring. Build out your equipment and figure out which hives you can use to jumpstart your nuke program. The advice from Michael Palmer is to split up your non-performing hives and subsequently offer your harvested donor frames productive queens. While that's sage and practical advice, I think most of the listeners here don't have bee yards full of bees. If you have one or two hives, pick one and build your management plan out of doing some splits to get you started. Of course, going into spring often means swarms, and that's a fantastic way to get some population for a fledgling nuke program. The good thing about nukes is once you have them established, you can actually split and split and split them to make more bees while your conventional hives are making honey for you. Using this split method, take a frame or two of bees, some pollen, some nectar, and one empty frame, and situate your nuke for a good start. Put a queen in there or harvest a queen cell from one of your hives that is getting in swarm preparation mode. You could do that pretty easily when there is a nectar flow, and it is a great way to get home-based queens right out of your yard. This is a topic unto itself, and I won't go into that here now, but one way or another, get your nuke set up and let it build out with fresh, vigorous population. When the bottom box gets full, put another on top of the stack. Intersperse frames between the two boxes on each other for a checkerboard pattern. Pull every other populated frame from the bottom up to the top and alternate them with foundation. More specifically said, there are 5 populated frames in a nuke. Pull frames 2 and 4 up to the top box. Try to leave the brood in the bottom. The bottom is situated like this. Comb with stores and brood. Foundation, brood frame, foundation, comb with stores and brood. The top box is comb with stores, foundation, comb with stores, foundation. Nope, did that wrong. It starts with foundation, comb with stores, foundation, comb with stores, foundation. It alternates. The point of doing this is that a foundation frame is always adjacent to a built-out frame. This entices the bees to build comb, and in a nectar flow, they will build it out quickly. That's why you start in spring. It also helps the bees build good comb, not wonky comb, because you've got an adjacent comb that has a built-out face, and the bees will maintain good bee space. In a time of nectar flow, bees want a place for their queen to lay, and they don't want to squander any opportunity to cache stores from nature, so they'll build out comb like no one's business. Now that you have bees and comb at your disposal, what can you do with them? Comb can supplement new hives, refresh old dodgy frames. You are rotating out your old comb out of your hives, right? And bees love to build out on fresh comb. As for bees, let me remind you what we learned in past episodes. Bees are loyal to the brood and not necessarily the queen. You can move frames in and out of hives and supplement what Mike Palmer refers to as production colonies, those full-size colonies that are making honey for you. Keep the queen in the box and move out some emerging brood frames from a nuc to a full-sized hive just before the honey season, and you have an instant explosion in the workforce right at the time when you need it. So all this theoretical is good, but let's talk about a little bit of management practices. Management of nucleus hives are highly dependent upon what's going on in your apiary. You have generally three major conditions. First one is when forage is abundantly available and the weather is good, these hives will thrive and need to be managed. Managed. Condition number two, when forage has ramped down but weather is good, these hives will be managed. And when forage is non-existent and weather is not suitable, these hives will have to be kept plausible until forage and weather is viable once again. During condition number one, once you have nucs established, you'll want to keep on top of them. If you lose track and ever get behind, you'll regret it. As Michael Palmer says, don't ever get behind. When your colonies are banging, keep tabs on their work. Are they building out white wax? Are they making queen cups? One thing about these hives is when you're in season, they are prolific and they will swarm due to the limited space. Practically, two boxes on top of each other are equivalent to one deep. We know from experience that one deep chock full will swarm, and it seems logical to think that bees will do the same in a two deep box configuration. So a number of options when they are chock full. You can use them for the utility, meaning harvest resources from them, as we've been talking about. Here's a Kevin moment. One observation that you'll have about a nuc hive and the comb they build is that they often don't build drone comb. They build worker comb, especially when you put foundation frames between brood frames. That's interesting, right? I don't know why that is, why they don't feel that they need to build drones. I always pondered that. End of Kevin moment. You can, when they're chock full, sell them. But make sure you're legit. Remember our state of affairs topic earlier. You'll want to be inspected and legit when you're selling bees. When they're chock full, you could move the whole nuc operation into a deep and start a new full-size colony. You can get ambitious and build out a queen yard. This is a bit of an advanced topic, but there's another angle of using nucs to be queen castles. Or how about this option when they're chock full? Just put more boxes on top. These hives are also great at storing honey, and they will make honey just like any other colony. All of these are valid options, but remember, don't get behind. But wait, another Kevin moment. I have this to say. What about releasing swarms for good of mankind? Touched on this on occasion. I'll come back to it. If you live in an unpopulated area, maybe it's not a bad thing to issue swarms. There's a great debate about whether these hives would survive on their own given the dreaded varroa mite, but folks, there are feral colonies found that have lived through beepocalypse, and if we're using good stock, hygienic queens and the like, isn't this what we want to be out in nature? I say, we beekeepers should not be so close-minded to allowing swarms of our good quality stock from issuing. Now, before you go off and do as I suggest, do keep in mind your surroundings. Responsible beekeepers don't let their stuff swarm into their neighbor's barn or eaves. They don't want them hanging off their mailbox down the road and causing mass hysteria. There are some of you, however, that are in remote areas of the world, and this option of letting them swarm would not be out of question. End of Kevin moment. Okay, condition number two. This is the no forage but viable weather situation. In some cases, you'll need to feed these colonies. If you've been using them for resources and the hive is not in a two configuration deep with balanced resources, then help them out. Remember that they don't have 10 full frames or 20 full frames, so they may not have the pollen or the nectar or whatever they need to keep things going. Feed them sugar solutions so they have their carbohydrates. Your area may vary, but I have to say, in my area, I don't think there's ever a time when bees can't find pollen. But if you're in an area that is scarce for that period of time, whatever it is, I don't think you're in a good place, but you could feed them pollen patties to keep them going. Okay, condition number three. This pretty much equates to late fall, winter, and early cold spring. In these cases, you want to overwinter your bees with reasonable stores and keep them as warm as you can. There are varying techniques here for accomplishing the overwinter configuration. You can place shims over full-size colonies that have dual screens and place the nukes on top. This allows the hives to share heat, which is a touch of a misnomer, but mostly right. In this situation, you can buy or build these devices that will allow you to stack two nuke boxes side by side on top of a conventional hive. Whatever heat is given off by the lower cluster of bees rises through the nukes and helps them along. You have to recall that nukes are mostly ambient temperature inside, and so are winter colonies, and whatever the temperature is outside, it's not like there are saunas inside the hive. So in winter, because the nukes don't have as many bees, whatever help they can get will help them through the winter. What you have to do is gather them together. Two nukes take advantage of the rising heat, but they also take advantage of being placed side by side. This is where that handle that I talked about would be a deterrent. You literally want wood touching wood. And the common wall, they can share the warmth between both hives sitting next to each other. For the observant of you visualizing about what it looks like, something doesn't compute. You can't take a telescoping cover on one hive and store it next to another with a telescoping cover and make them touch. That's correct. In this situation, where you have two hives sitting next to each other, beekeepers use migratory covers or they use a full cover over top of them. It depends on the dimension of the box that you're using. A migratory cover was designed in a way that you could stack hives next to each other, and they're often used when hives are put on pallets for shipping. They consist of a flat board, the width of a nuke, but they are longer than the longest dimension and they hang over the front and back. They have a cleat nailed under the overlap to keep them from moving back and forth and falling off. Now, some beekeepers forgo the stack method and just winter nukes in their standard configuration, meaning on a bottom board with two deeps and a roof. I can't say that I've heard of folks using standalone single nuke deeps over top of each other to overwinter, meaning just a standalone nuke by itself. In almost all cases, I believe that two nukes are used sitting side by side so they could share the heat. If you have an abundance of nukes, you could stack them shoulder to shoulder on one common area, and for added protection, I know that many wrap these hives with tar paper for a little added R factor. The obligatory comment about wrapping is worthwhile here. Make sure you leave a place for the bees to exit and to allow for ventilation. Wet moisture cocoons are not good things and bees will need to make cleansing flights. I know from a recent talk that Landy Simone of Goose Rock Farms in New Jersey is trying one additional wrinkle in wrapping. She wraps with bubble wrap first, then tar paper for a bit of added insulation. That's interesting, don't you think? After you have them nestled in, you might spot check them during the winter for stores. You want to feed them in early spring if they've been active. I guess it all depends upon what kind of winter you've had. Some winters, like the one we had 2 years ago, are warmer than usual, and the bees will stay more active, which equates to more stores being consumed. Other winters keep bees in a little more dormant and inactive state, which tends to allow their stores to last a little bit longer. A full-size colony in the northeast of the United States requires 60 to 80 pounds of honey to overwinter. A nuke is equivalent to one box in volume, but they don't have as many bees to generate warmth, and in my mind, I've always reasoned that they consume more stores to keep warm, basically doing more heating operations to overwinter. I'd be interested in knowing if others think that is true, too. I guess I've been going on for a long time now, so let me cover a few more highlights and then close this down. There's a lot to talk about here on Nukes. If you are a new beekeeper, nuke colonies are a joy to work with. Pat Haskell from Virginia always emphasizes that nuke hives are great teaching tools. She's the one that emphasizes that nuke hives are like large hives in miniature. The small footprint of a nucleus hive makes it so much easier to see things. In 5 frames, you have the whole factory. The brood area, the pollen area, the nectar stores area, it's all there for you to see. Finding the queen is easy peasy. She's on one of the 5 frames, and in short order, she'll be in your sights. It's a great way to get bearings in the hive if you're new and unsure of what you're looking at. Now, early queens. Getting queens in the northeast in early spring is a difficult thing to do. A quality queen needs to be well mated, and in early spring, with the high demand of queen rearing in the United States, it means that what is coming your way in a cage is suspect at times. If you ask me, besides the potential energy of the brood, the quality of the queen is probably the second most important aspect of beekeeping. Now let's see. Take a laying queen, one that may or may not have been well mated, and pull her off the comb. Put her in a box and mail her to her destination. It's 800 miles from Georgia to New Jersey in a 12-hour drive. She's in a truck, maybe climate controlled, maybe not. But what does climate controlled mean to a queen in a box? Then ask her to pick up where she left off and start laying again like nothing happened if she happens to be accepted. Now, if you've ever made that 12-hour trip, let me ask you, how good are you when you get to your destination? So maybe this is humanizing things too much and a stupid point. I'll let you be the judge of that. But contrast that about going into your nuke in your yard and pulling a queen from your bees and walking over to one of your queenless colonies and dropping her right in. She was just laying, so they'll readily accept her. Tell me which one is likely to have a better outcome. The nuke, it will be fine after you pull the queen out. They have young brood from that same queen, and they will make you a new queen without any fuss from you. Middle of summer, queens stop shipping from parts of afar, and you have no queen in your hives. Not to worry, you can combine that hive with one of your nukes and you'll be okay. Suffering from winter losses lately and don't know if you could take it anymore? Want to get off the package treadmill? Overwintering your colonies with some nukes for any standard colony that doesn't make it, replace it in the spring with one of the nukes. This is sustainability, and they say that nukes that overwinter become bee bombs in the spring. They grow and thrive like nobody's business. Now, for all the good, there are some downsides to nukes, and I don't want to dwell on them here, but I'm going to raise them for awareness. The swarming potential that we mentioned and some of the overhead for management to prevent said swarming is a little bit of work. Yes, you have to purchase more equipment if that's the approach you take by building nukes. And now you have nukes and full deeps and mediums and other stuff sitting in your yard. Now you could use a standard box and put a divider in between. You just have to make sure you construct it properly so they can't cross from one side to another. And it does mean that you may have to feed these colonies. New colonies, especially new ones, can't defend from robbing, like a full-sized one. The short of it is, there are a few considerations, but nothing that can't be overcome by some experience and common sense. So there's probably a number of other things that could be said about the practices of using nukes in your bee yard, but I'm guessing that your eyes might be glazed over by now. I'll emphasize what Michael Palmer said at the talk he gave in January at the ABF conference. For him, new colonies made beekeeping fun again. Losing colonies, buying bees, not making honey, that's not fun. Solving the problems by having resources at your disposal to cure what ails you makes beekeeping fun again, and you feel like you're in charge of your own destiny. I'm all for it, and hopefully this has inspired you to take a look at this practice and consider nukes for your 2014 beekeeping season. In support of this segment, I'll provide some links to resources about Nuke Hive practices. There are a plethora of resources on the internet to buy and learn about nuke management practices. For segment number three, I want to talk about the Bayer B-gate. I know that sounds funny because of the way Bayer is perceived. And no, I'm not talking about a water gate. I'm talking about a product that they make called a B-gate. So it bothers me that I have to start this segment with a disclaimer, but I know that I'll get feedback for giving something like this topic airtime. With all due respect to anyone who takes issue to this, I say get over it, for I have no agenda, no allegiance. I call things as I see them, and I find it interesting and novel, so I present it. Now with the disclaimer out of the way, let's talk about the Bayer B-gate. Bayer, the same company that makes some of the neonicotinoid pesticides that beekeepers like to loathe, are working on an idea to deliver varroa mite treatments in what I see as a novel way. The concept is creating a gate made of plastic that is impregnated with an acaricide and provides metered dosage to bees as they pass through. An acaricide is akin to a substance that kills tick-like critters. And of course we want to control varroa mites as they do evil things in our hives, not the least of which is to vector viruses and make our bees sick. From Bayer's website, quote, "The varroa gate protects honeybees. Bees brush against the anti-mite chemical on the entrance hole when they return to the hive, taking it inside with them. Fresh supplies of the chemical are immediately released from the core of the plastic strip to its surface, ensuring long-term protection." Quote. At the core of Bayer's technology is the ability for the plastic gate to release the anti-mite chemical over a sustained period of time. That's interesting, and in their trials they indicate that, quote, "The findings to date show that bees have been fully protected against reinfection and no side effects have been seen," end quote. It goes on further to say that scientists are conducting a battery of tests to find out the right delicate balance between shape, formulation, and function. They have to consider the hole sizes, the distances between the holes and the way they're laid out, and so on. The technology for releasing the formulation is also key, and Bayer has gone back to their experience with tick collars worn by dogs and cats. They have a flea and tick collar impregnated with imidacloprid, a product that we're all familiar with, and an anti-mite acaricide chemical called flumerathin. They go on to indicate that these products work synergistically in the dog and cat collars to control fleas and ticks. Using that same strategy, they may be able to use this knowledge of their product line for delivery of acaricides to bees and a means of varroa control. So let me distance myself from the evil thoughts of the insecticides rotting on the back of an insect for a moment and say to me that the plastic seems to work a little like wax. It's impregnated with a chemical and it gives off, my words, metered dosage when you come in contact. As the product or chemical is taken off the surface, it appears to make a void in the storage of chemicals in that area and results and the chemicals in the product redistributing themselves in a way that releases more chemicals at the surface area. In my mind, it's like the reverse of wax, which absorbs and distributes chemicals coming in. Using Bayer's words, the surface is replenished with chemicals in preparation for the next bee to come along. Deliveries of product are interesting, and in this case, the plastic can be dosed with something that might last for weeks and serve as an alternative to the non-gas-like delivery to bees. Gasification of chemicals seems to be one of the more prevalent methods these days for delivery and sometimes depend upon the weather. Hives really get dosed occasionally when it gets really hot, and perhaps this is a new and novel way to deliver a product in a more consistent manner. Now let me have some editorial on this, and yes, from me. I'm not sure what Mike Poison Bayer is intending to put in here, and have my thoughts on agendas and profits when considering this. If the product could be something natural, should that even be plausible, then perhaps there's a sustainable way to make this an effective product and delivery method. The other thought is you can load in different substances in the plastic. Rotation of different products could prevent mites from becoming acclimated to one type of product that have different delivery objectives to chemicals. I also wonder about all of these bees flying around with insecticides on them, but if you think about it, several of the delivery methods we have today, as a part of their strategy of transmission, the product throughout the hive is transmitted by the bees through physical contact. So for example, Apigard has a tray, and one of the things they want is the bees to carry it out, and in the course of carrying it out, they transmit it throughout the hive. And they do have plastic strips that you put inside the hive, different products that you can do that the bees come in contact with. So doing this contact thing is possibly not so bad. It's equivalent to what we have. Anyway, in the end, it's an interesting idea, and Bayer is doing the science as they have to in order to determine if this is a good solution for bees. As a disclaimer, I work for a pharmaceutical company and have a notion of what the practices are before they can release something like this to the public. I won't go out on a limb and say all pharmas are squeaky clean, but on the whole, most of them are reputable and responsible, and I wouldn't hesitate keeping an open mind about a solution like this. It's worth saying that some of the most widely respected, widely used, and popular products in use today are of course made by peers of Bayer, and we don't question their efficacy when applying them to our hives. So the last little thing about it is they emphasize the fact that the bees are coming in and carrying the product into the hive. Of course they are going out and carrying the product away from the hive. There's some things that have to be kind of considered about all of that. The risk management and the potential for a spread of whatever chemical they put in and its delivery to plants and things like that, it all has to be considered. So, you know, it pains me to have to be apologetic for this topic, but I know how passionate beekeepers are when it comes to these proposed solutions, especially by companies that have perceived reputation for putting profits before safe practices. In this case, I'll watch what happens and use common sense when it comes to my purchases and applaud Bayer for the work they're doing for honeybees. Look for a link to the product overview in our show notes so you can check it out for yourself. It's time for us to move into our roundtable segment of the podcast. This is where we go through a smattering of topics, local news, things like that. Roundtable number one, the lost episode, and a best of suggestion. I was doing some cleanup on my website and made a discovery that one of the episodes was missing from the feed list. Episode 39 is titled Smorgasbord, and it was not on the list for some reason. The links were on the website, but not in the feed. And if you look at our podcast in iTunes or FeedBurner, then you probably have not seen this one. I'm not sure how the omission occurred, but the problem is resolved. If you've missed that one, then you'll get a two-for-one deal this week, as you can go back and listen to it. I think I'll have to download that episode and give it a listen, as it's been a while since I've checked in on it. The episode was recorded this past March, and I know that one of the topics covered there was some commentary on Tim Ives, who came to New Jersey to speak. Related to this topic, and I had an idea about a best-of show. I have the recordings of all the segments of previous years and wondered if it would be interesting to go back through 2013 and assemble a best-of or highlight episode to end the year. What do you think about that? Weigh in on the segments or features stuck with you, and if I get responses, I'll go back and assemble a special end-of-year best-of episode. You can send your suggestions to kevin@bkcorner.org, or you can help me by telling what feature or topic you'd like and what episode it was from on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. Roundtable 2 topic, honey caramel sauce. I use Windows 8 on a Microsoft Surface device that I have on loan from work. I'm using the device to learn more about working mostly on mobile devices, as I support people who work on mobile devices as their primary work style, and sometimes you need to eat your own dog food, as it were. Windows 8 OS comes with some built-in software, and one of the applications is an excellent food and drink app produced by the people who bring you the search engine Bing. I love to cook and find it relaxing to mine cooking sources for recipes that I might consider. I added a link to my someday maybe list for recipes for honey caramel sauce. I sit here and look over at the accompanying photo, and I can't help be reminded of the creamed honey that I talked about in our last episode. It seemed relatively easy to make, except for one aspect. It requires you to have a thermometer, as you have to get to a specific temperature for the caramel to work. So here's what you need if you want to make it at home. The ingredient list: a half cup of heavy cream, 1.5 cups of honey, a tablespoon of butter, 1 teaspoon of vanilla, and 1/8 teaspoon of salt. To make the sauce, combine the heavy cream and honey together and cook it on the stove over medium-high heat until it reaches 238 degrees Fahrenheit. Continuously stir it. When it comes up to temperature, it will burn. When it comes to temperature, take it off the heat and stir in the remaining ingredients. Cool it slightly and serve it over ice cream, drizzle on cake or pie. Heck, you could probably just eat it off the spoon if that makes you happy. Whatever you don't eat can be refrigerated. When you want to use it next time, you have the option of microwaving it briefly to warm for serving. For Thanksgiving, I made a cheesecake. Yum. This would be great on top of that. I think I'll have to try that tonight. Next up on the roundtable, roundtable number 3, a DIY website bee trap suggestion. Marty King, a listener of the podcast, sent me a link to a website from the DIY channel about building a trap for controlling bees in your yard. I've said it before that if bees are a nuisance, take the scenario of unwanted visits at a swimming pool, that you could kill, terminate a couple bees to prevent the scouts from getting back home and telling the colony something you don't want them to know. The method for doing this is squirting them with some soapy water. Now, the DIY website is advocating building a trap out of sugary substance and a cut-off 2-liter bottle configured in a way to let bees in but prevent them from escaping. I always thought traps like this were counterproductive. The famed beetle trap is known far and wide for attracting beetles to your property. The bug lamps of the 90s were also professed as counterintuitive as they drew bugs in from far and wide. There's a certain tone to this article that was sourced that indicates that this might work like a lure. Fundamentally, that seems flawed. I think it's a bit naive when you have competing sources of forage that an insect is going to choose the trap over your soda can. In my estimation, it doesn't work that way. It's not like they're going to see the trap and say, "Nah, I won't bother with the soda can. The trap has better food." The other thing is that some of these insects are meat eaters, and sugary traps are not going to resolve the problem. I consider this a misguided advice for making people feel good about controlling dangerous and horrible stinging insects, and I'd be surprised if it were an effective means for resolving a bee problem. Kevin moment. This gets me thinking about something. Would a bee go back to the hive after finding a can of soda and do a waggle dance? That's an interesting thought, isn't it? If the answer happens to be yes, then perhaps the trap does have one advantage, which of course is not to our liking, in that the scout bees go in and they don't go out, so they won't report back. End of Kevin moment. My hope is that this page is buried in the depths of the website and won't see a lot of traffic. I get the impression, and it's easy to diss DIY, that people writing copy are just populating answers for page views. More content coupled with search engine optimization means greater brand name for DIY, more visitorship, and more views mean greater ad revenue. Simple fact is, content, even questionable of value, is good business for DIY. Perhaps they could show some integrity and go to an informed source to get insights on how to resolve such problems, especially if they're going to be a reputable source of information or widely used resource. This is the knock that people have on Answers.com, sometimes on Wikipedia, sometimes even on WebMDB, any of these places that provide answers like that. Anyway, if you'd like to see the self-help article in question, check our show notes. We'll provide a link. And perhaps you want to leave a comment there for the DIY staff. And that is your option. For Roundtable 4, I want to talk about the hive stand upgrade. I built a hive stand for my yard out of PVC pipe. The design's on our website, and I've had good utility over what has been deployed. That being said, I'm always on the lookout for utility options and saw something at Home Depot that tweaked my interest. The Depot sells plastic utility shelving that is made to hold a reasonable amount of weight. You know, stuff you'd put in your laundry room, your garage, to stack stuff on. When looking at this product that they have for sale, it indicates that it will hold 1,000 pounds. The concept is that each shelf, there are five of them, can take up to 200 pounds. I had a chance to see these in the store, and they are heavy duty. The other thing is that the reviews are highly complimentary of the product. People have written numerous comments about ease of assembability and assembly and their durability. There you go. So immediately my mind starts to think maybe there's a way to use these as a hive stand. A few things come into mind when looking at them in no particular order. First one is, will they hold up outside? Sun degrades plastic. They're not unlike PVC, which also degrades, but my hive stands have held up so nicely that maybe these will too. Will the plastic be too slippery? Will the bottom board made out of wood slide all over the place? And if so, maybe there's a way to put some clips to keep the bottom boards in place. It's worth the trouble, I think, to solve this problem. Will the shelves warp when they get hot and they have a lot of weight on them? That's a possible thought. They seem to be well ventilated and would work well under a hive, and they would not, in my estimation, deter a screen bottom board, so that's a plus. I would consider splitting each of these shelves into a separate hive. Would the poles supplied work in that manner, or could I replace them with my own PVC base that I construct myself? A good thing about them is they're plastic. They'll never rot. The bad thing is they could potentially infect the environment when they are ready to be discarded. So they're made from a readily recyclable material. Yay, that's a good thing. Now, here's the last thought I have about looking at them. Could a homemade base provide more support and structure capability when making an attractive platform? And for me, that's what it's about. I like to get the hives up off the ground, keep them away from the moisture. Two, I like to have whatever it is I'm putting my hives on be proper utility. And these things are wide enough that if the hive is sitting on them, I have a place to put my smoker down, my tool, not set them down on the ground. The other thing about the current hive stand, when I put my hanger on it and I hang my frames, sometimes the hangers get to that when I'm in the bottom box. This, I think, would work a little bit better. So I'm always looking for better ideas. And the other thing is, if you could build a separate base, I think these could be very attractive looking. These are all interesting speculations, and it seems that there's a test purchase in my future. If you want to see this shelf that I'm looking at, check our show notes. For our final roundtable, subject roundtable number 5, intelligent hive sensors, I have a recent email from a listener about intelligent hive sensors being implanted in honeybee hives. Recently, I went to a show in New York City where they were selling computer parts that you could hook to all kinds of sensors. Intriguing were the sensors for temperature, moisture, and other things. The company I saw there was called Spark Fun, all one word, electronics. The basic premise is you purchase a main board and then use these modular parts to enable the sensors that you want. At their site, it looks like you could be far more ambitious all the way to building out a robot, if that was your objective. There's another well-promoted functionality like this called Raspberry Pi. Raspberry, common spelling, Pi spelled P-I, like the science one. And it, too, provides you a main board with a bunch of different connectors to it, and you can build sprinkler systems and so on. I suspect the year of 2014-15, these 2 years, will be the year of home automation and a return to the gadgets that you used to have in the 70s where you could buy a kit from Radio Shack and build all kinds of stuff. That seems to be very popular in this notion, and it's good for us because if we ever wanted to do some ambitious home DIY automated hive monitoring stuff, we would have the tools at our disposal, because I don't know how many of you could build a main board. I certainly couldn't. The link that was sent to me echoes the notion of sensors in the hive by building an intelligent Waré-style hive. There's a video of the effort and the engineering that goes into this, and you could give it a look by going to Vimeo, Vimeo.com/6611-3817. Vimeo.com/6611-3817. If you missed it, see the link in our show notes, and thanks to the listener with the handle S'morning for sending it along. That wraps up this episode. I want to get to a couple closing comments. A bit ago, I shared a request for listeners to provide a review of our podcast at the iTunes store if possible. Doing so helps us to get more exposure and return on investment for the work that we put in. One thing that's always aggravated me about the way Apple ranks shows, podcast shows, is that they allow stuff that hasn't produced episodes for years to be in the top of the list on results when searching on the topic of beekeeping or any other topic for that matter. The point of bringing this up is that some comments were added, and that is great. I wanted to call out one specific comment here, and that was from someone with the handle, I Gotta Get a Life, all one word. It put a smile on my face, but not for reasons that you might think. It says, and I quote, "You may not agree with his practices, at least I don't, but you'll be intrigued to try things on your own." Yes, I love that. I know as a novice beekeeper that I'm not an expert. I read things, I interpret them, and I share my summations with you. I don't profess that I have the right answers, and I certainly don't think that all of my practices are right. I experiment here and there, and quite frankly, diversity in each beekeeper's situation makes it ironclad that what works for one, specifically me, will not work for everyone, the rest of you. I'm here to learn, and I'm here to help you gather your way. And I would imagine that podcasters want everyone to roll over and tell them that they're great and be talking heads and, you know, Kevin said this and Kevin said that. I'm really not into that. I appreciate the candor, especially when it's well-placed, but I'm not encouraging you to go to iTunes and profess that to the entire world that I'm a bonehead, but I'm not afraid of transparent feedback. In fact, I really like that. So that being said, my request still stands. You could help us out by posting a review in iTunes. It seems the ranking engine weighs heavily on the quantity of reviews. So I wanted to share a couple things in life that have come on and just give a shout out to my soccer team. Soccer ended this past weekend and our team went to the annual tournament. Been going there for 12, 13 years and made the championships one but never won the tournament. My team played with such heart and determination, and they won, and I am so proud of them that I have to share it here in the public forum. Great job for the Phoenix. You guys and gal, I have one girl on my team, did us proud. So brings a close to another episode. Comments, suggestions, and any other words of encouragement can find their way to us via my email address, kevin@bkcorner.org. Until we meet again in the next episode, we wish you the best and thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.